Laura Hojibum settled in Hovland in the early 1900s. She came across Lake Superior on the steamship America. A tall, slender woman in her 20s, she left her home, her parents, and 10 brothers and sisters behind. One of her brothers, Frank, had left home a few years before to homestead in Hovland. Laura was close to Frank and ended up acquiring a piece of land just 2 miles down the North Road in Hovland from her brother. Phil Anderson has studied Hovland history and stories of migration.
Laura comes in as an early female homesteader, which I believe makes her unique in Hovland. I've not encountered that before, the way her story begins. It was fairly remote. She was about 5 miles from Chicago Bay, which was the hub of things. And she had a brother next door, and there were neighbors, of course, but it was pretty isolated. So her story is fascinating, and the more that can be learned about it and told is a wonderful thing. For a woman who is in her later 20s, maybe 26, 27 years old, to make a move like that to Hovland was a pretty significant thing. And to homestead, and the part of her story we do know through her niece and others, it really shows a pretty remarkable woman.
Carrie McHugh is the director of the Cook County Historical Society.
You would think there was some sense of isolation, but I also get the sense that there was a really strong community. They had a school organized. Laura was involved with the school. They had a church. Her brother donated the property that the Trinity Lutheran Church would be built on and that the cemetery now is at. So I even though it was back in the woods and away from some of the transportation hubs, I just get the sense that there was a strong community and life was probably hard, but they all banded together and worked for one another. And clearly someone like Laura filled a really important role in an isolated area like that. I'm sure it wasn't easy. I'm positive of that.
It was a pretty lively place and not a bad place to be. From all accounts, she enjoyed it. She loved it there. And early on, she learned to provide not only for herself the ability to shoot deer or moose or raise that garden, but I think one of the most special parts of her story is how she gave herself to the community by caring for other people.
Carla is Laura's granddaughter. She uncovered and recorded Laura's story through a series of interviews with her Aunt Hazel, one of Laura's daughters. She wrote Laura's story up and sent it out to the family at Christmas.
Well, I think I said in the story that I wrote about her how she could take almost any type of animal and turn it into some succulent meal. I think there was a mention of a porcupine or something in the story. She could pass it off as roast beef or whatever. So she must have known her spices and things, although I can't imagine back then there were like 2 spices, salt and pepper, unless there was something more available that we weren't aware of in this day and age. But the fact that she wasn't one of these women who just took care of her family. She took in ironing and washing, as I said in the story, and that's when everyone wore white shirts with long sleeves and you had to press them just so and get creases in them. Plus she was the janitor at the country school, and she, you know, treated the kids with cookies and things, and there was no running water and all the water had to be pulled, you know, out of the flute reed back then.
Laura was a very self-sufficient woman, and not unwilling to do what was needed in a number of situations. Her devotion to her brother was especially strong. She saw him nearly every day.
The thing I remember about it is that she hadn't seen him for a long enough period that she was concerned. I think this was the story where then she set out at night, but this was a dangerous thing to do, or her sense was it was dangerous that there could be wolves out in the woods. So she set out at night with a pitchfork, I think, as her protection, and then went out to see how he was doing and found that he was homesick. And then, again, she tended to his health.
Well, I suppose she, you know, she was alone and she had only herself to depend on. So she probably just had to, you do what you have to do type of thing. And I mean, that's in the story when Auntie Hazel was telling me about she had the pitchfork and she had the I think birch bark on the tines, and she set them on fire and she could hear the wolves and was like, help. I mean, she probably thought, well, I have to do this, and there's nobody else that's going to do this. So it was kind of like, I could either sit home and twiddle my thumbs and worry about my brother, or I can go and check on him and go out and do these things.
Laura also had a love for animals, both domesticated and wild.
Well, Grandma and her brother, Frank, my great uncle Frank, were, I don't know, if they were out for a walk one day and they heard this bawling sound, you know. The moose normally don't make noise unless they're in trouble. Kind of like a rabbit. Rabbits don't make noises normally either. But anyway, the moose was making this noise, but at that time they didn't know what it was. So they searched around in the woods and they found this baby moose. And its foot was wedged between two logs. And the mother probably, because she didn't know how to release the leg of the little moose, she abandoned it. And so Grandma and Frank were able to, of course, get the logs apart. And when they did that, I think the little moose probably thought, well, this is my mama or something again, because the little moose followed them home. And so Grandma just kept him at her house. Well, he was almost like a pet dog. He would follow her around, and she fed him and everything. And that little guy had a tragic end, too, because there was like a dish rag on the line that was drying, and the little guy ate it. And he must have strangled on it from, you know, in his throat, because he died. And so that was a very sad ending. Grandma felt very bad about that.
You know, in that story, there's also the reference to the grief that Laura felt for a long time. So it shows her connection to all living creatures, probably, and respect for that, and her attachment. And of course, by this time, she's married and she has 5 daughters, so she's got a bustling family of her own. But a very human story about pets, only, and rescuing pets, only in this case it's a moose.
They always had horses, and they had some smart horses. One of the horses, I think I mentioned her in here, and I can't remember her name right now.
Was it Maud?
Maud, yes, it was Maud. Maud was a very smart horse. She knew that if she opened the door to the house and stuck her head in there, and she could do that with her mouth, I think, that there was sugar lumps in there. And so Grandma, sugar lumps, or maybe a carrot or an apple or something like that.
And the picture of her raising 5 kids and she must have had an enormous amount of energy and dedication, and probably did all of this pretty cheerfully and routinely rather than grudgingly. It'd be interesting to know, is there any aspect of community life she wasn't involved in? Maybe politics or something like that, but she was very... The Harriman family was very engaged. In the various communities that made up Hovland, She's sort of up on the North Road, the beginning of the North Road, which is above the Flute Reed Valley settlement and the Poplar Hill settlement. And there were needs for schools. Her family was involved in donating the land for the church. That's really important to a community, but schools are important as well. And I believe that among the many things she did, she worked as a janitor in the school for something like 18 years. So simply to say that there probably wasn't an aspect of community life she was not involved in.
The one thing that I, other than that, that I couldn't believe was when they would take Hazel and Evelyn with them and walk 5 miles to Hovland and drop the two girls off at one of their friends' house who had a teenage daughter and go and dance all night. Grandpa would do the calls because it was square dancing. You'd do the calls for the square dancing. Then when they were done dancing, they'd come back, pick up the two girls and walk home. And of course the girls would be sleeping, so they'd have to, you know, the girls wouldn't be walking, they'd have to carry the girls home. But I can't imagine doing that, and then the next day you have two little kids who are up and you haven't slept all night because you're out dancing all night. So it's just too many things to think that they did, and I get exhausted just thinking about some of this stuff.
But I think one of the most special parts of her story is how she gave herself to the community by caring for other people, and particularly in medical ways. And she was a person of very deep religious conviction, almost to the extent of being a faith healer or having a strong awareness of a spiritual presence when she was attending to a person's physical needs in physical ways. You know, she would feel a hand on her, or, you know, there's that dimension that I think also makes her very intriguing. Many dimensions to her.
The thing to me that is the most fun of all is, and interesting of all, is that she was a healer and she was kind of a medicine woman and the go-to person in the area when someone was sick, or she was also a midwife and she'd deliver babies. I mean, to me, that's what an essential role she played, and what a remarkable role.
It was kind of like the story of the hunter who was hunting, and he frostbit his feet so badly, and I don't know exactly what Grandma did to warm them up, but she saved his life, saved his feet. So she just had, as I said in there, the cupboard remedies of different homespun medicine, kind of the folk medicine, you might as well say. She was just gifted in so many areas.
Laura saved the life of her grandson, Glenn.
Glenn was born prematurely, and between his dad and Grandma, they kept him alive. They built an incubator. They had it out of a cigar box, I believe, and I think they had cotton batting in there, and they kept him in the oven. They had the oven on real low so it was warm, and they had the door open, of course, but it was just enough heat to keep him warm. Glenn grew up to be a man, 6'5", probably 200 pounds. He grew up to be a very large man, and the fact that he survived in a time where they knew so little about premature babies, and babies were born at home back then, and he's also deceased now, but he was just, the odds were definitely against him surviving. But Grandma and her son-in-law Oscar kept him alive, and I don't think he had any ill effects, any congenital things from being born early or anything like that, which is just, that could blow a person away right there.
Hovland remains pretty remote until the 1920s, when with the advent of the automobile, then you start developing Trunk Highway 1, which is now Highway 61 up the shore. But back then, if there were needs, you know, the doctor was here in Grand Marais. You needed people like Laura, who was present and knew what to do. There is a story, of course, in the account of Laura by her niece. Mons Hansen and his family were nearly the most remote. They were up at the end of the county road that's now plowed and where the Camp 20 road keeps going, unmaintained, on Hong Hill. So that was quite a ways, in a way, from where Laura was. And their son died of diphtheria. And the story is that because it was such a highly contagious disease and little understood by many at that time, Laura was the only one who went up to the Hansen farm and knocked on the door and said, "Can you give me your son's measurements so I can inform the undertaker and we'll have a suit of clothes for him?" So she gave no concern to whether she was going to be infected with diphtheria. She didn't enter the house, but she was not afraid to make a considerable effort to do that. And I think that shows both a medical awareness of when there are needs, you are present and you help. But it probably says something about her character, too. She's caring for the family. She's thinking about what's coming next, given the fact that their son has died. So it's more than a medical need that she's filling. So, but to have delivered 50 babies in that kind of setting, she probably saw a lot, and she probably dealt with stillborn children and the grief in families. So I think what we do know about her giving to the community in that way, with her sort of religious core, probably meant that in those settings, people felt that they had a pastor as well in some way.
I recall that she just didn't have a fear. I think where a lot of other people would have had a fear of the unknown, of the diseases that cause death, and she seemed to just have a confidence in, or maybe it was just something in her heart that said, "I need to be helpful at times like these."
The one thing that was just really incredible was when these children died of these childhood diseases, and she was the one who would go, excuse me, to the homes of these people and talk to the parents through the door and would help, what were they, you know, the morticians were called undertakers back then, and have to get the dimensions of the child so they could get the coffin sizes correct. And everyone else was just deathly afraid of being anywhere near someone who had one of these diseases, you know, like scarlet fever or something like on that order that killed people, and it was so contagious. And it was surprising that she never contracted any of these things herself, just going there. And the fact that she helped deliver so many babies, being a midwife too, the woman had so many talents.
Carla uncovered something about her grandmother that she never expected to find. It turns out Laura had a secret, something she'd kept hidden her whole life. Laura had another child, a daughter out of wedlock. There's speculation that perhaps this child is why Laura left her home in Wisconsin.
And then, of course, about 20 years or so ago came the big surprise when we discovered Frances, when my aunt Merle was up in the Grand Marais area, and she went to visit a lady down in Schroeder, which is also on the shore up there in Grand Marais. And this lady was the one person that my grandma Laura had entrusted the secret of this little girl who had such a brief life. She was born in 1905 and died in 1908, and her name was Frances Adele Hojibun. And my Aunt Merle had all of her sisters there, and she brings out this old-fashioned frame, and in the frame is a photograph of Grandma Laura holding a little girl. And they all go, well, who's mom holding? Well, that's our sister who died. Well, it was like everyone was just blown away. She was a single woman. And we, when we all found out that, it was just, we were all just shocked. And since that time, and since I've retired, it's kind of a quest of mine. I'd like to find out where she is buried. I do have a copy of the death certificate, and there is a father's name on there. And I even did a little research on that, looking at his name and going back, you know, Googling the name and putting in some dates that I thought he might have been around. And I found two men with the same name. And I thought, well, I don't know. You just don't know if that's what the situation was. Or then you wonder if, do you think maybe she just invented a name to put on there?
So after she had found that information, she shared it with me because here we are now. We're intrigued and want to find out about this mystery. So she shared that death certificate information with me. And I continued to kind of dig into the records because she also wanted to know where this child was then buried. So I continued to dig in a little bit more and found information about another death in the family at the same time from a similar cause. Actually, a cousin of Frances Adele's passed away within days of some similar intestinal problem, but she was about the same age. And so just interesting that there was a problem maybe in the water supply or something that was causing young kids to get sick. Now, just today I was looking in our newspapers of 1908, and I noticed one of the captions was "Many Sick," and I hadn't run across this before. And sure enough, lots of children in September of that year were getting sick from something. And it may be because it was a drought year, maybe the water quality was poor, I'm not sure, but it certainly was a trend and it was an isolated incident.
And we have always kind of had a hunch that maybe she brought her home to Hovland and buried her on the property. Does that mean the laws and regulations for stuff like that, I'm sure we're pretty lax. They weren't what they are today. So, you know, that's one piece of the puzzle that we'd like to fill in and just give her a little justice. You know, this little girl who was probably a horrible embarrassment for the family that she was out of wedlock, and you know, and ideas and feelings and emotions about all this type of thing have changed a lot through the years.
Well, certainly when it comes to the question of whether or not she moved here because she was pregnant, and ethically you think, oh boy, that's too bad that she had that sense. Nowadays, so often this happens with young women, and there isn't the sense that you have to run from that. So that would seem too bad that that her young child went unacknowledged because of those moral and ethical concerns that I'm sure she had. So that's one big thing. You can kind of notice the change in culture that maybe in this day and age that wouldn't have happened. But again, it's that pioneering spirit for me that really fills the gaps. I mean, we at the Historical Society, we know people's names and we know dates and we know a lot of facts about a lot of men, for example, and some of the big important decisions that happened in government, all of that stuff. But Laura's story is a woman's story that is really fleshed out.
But what were those first 2 years like for Laura? And especially if in the middle of those 2 years you lose your daughter, that's what makes a story special. So the more her story can be told, I think it is a window into all the stories we may not know about people like her.
We know a lot about who she was because of women. They continue to tell her story till this day. So, and it's not just the story of what were the important decisions made and who were the movers and shakers. It's just a day-to-day life story, and to me, it's just rich that way. You get so much more of the subtle details that really make you understand the humans who were there, not just the facts and the dates of what was going on. It's kind of hard. In fact, it's kind of easy when you're the historian to look to the political things and to look to some of the economic things, because those are things that are recorded. Oftentimes, what happens in the home just happens in the home. Nobody's busy writing it down and taking minutes for what goes on every day in the home. So I think sometimes it's just easier to get at that history, but it doesn't mean that the other histories aren't out there.
Knowing all this stuff has given me an even greater appreciation for what these early pioneer women went through. When we look at the lives, the hardship, we view it as hardship. They probably viewed it, well, everyone else is living the same way. They have the same, what I would call inconveniences, and they would call them, well, this is life. This is, you deal with it, and you move on. Whereas we would say, oh, how could you do that? No running water, no electricity. Washing clothes, you have to heat water on the stove. It was almost like you're thinking, oh my gosh, you heard about people beating clothes on a rock or something. Well, they didn't do that, but it was still, there was just, no microwaves, no stoves that you turn on at a flip of a switch, and no dishwashers. Everything was done by hand and backs, you might as well say. You had to have a strong back and just a strong mind, I guess, and to just survive so many things. And it's just, you look at that and you think, wow, you really appreciate what these women and these men went through and how they survived and thrived. To just kind of say, well, I'm doing this for you, Grandma, posthumously, of course, but we got some record of your life now, and even though it doesn't include everything, at least we got a lot of information here, and hopefully everyone that reads it can enjoy this and just realize the trials and tribulations people had years ago and the things they did basically to make a better life for those of us that came after them. And she was just a wonderful woman.
History Speaks is funded in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Amendment, supporting arts, culture, and history programs on WTIP.